rockets over there and killing innocent people in Pakistan. And so we should not accept that. We should look for a peace movement to join. Really, look for some peace organization to join. It will look small at first and pitiful and helpless, but that's how movements start. That's how the movement against the Vietnam War started. Started with handfuls of people who thought they were helpless, thought they were powerless. But remember this, the power of the people on top depends on the obedience of the people below. When people stop obeying, they have no power. Now, when workers go on strike, huge corporations lose their power. When consumers boycott, huge business establishments have to give in. When soldiers refuse to fight, as so many soldiers did in Vietnam, so many deserters, so many fraggings, acts of violence by enlisted men against officers in Vietnam, B-52 pilots refusing to fly bombing missions anymore, war can't go on. When enough soldiers refuse, the government has to decide we can't continue. So yes, people have the power if they begin to organize, if they protest, if they create a strong enough movement, they can change things. That's all I want to say.
Historian Howard Zinn speaking in 2009, just months before his death. Northwestern professor Kianga Yamata-Taylor has written, "We need Howard Zinn now more than ever, not for the sake of romance or to construct another hero in history. We need his insights, his politics, and his commitment to the struggle for a better world." And that does it for our centennial, celebrating the historian Howard Zinn, born 100 years ago in 1922. Special thanks to Mike Burke, Neil Shabata, and Brendan Allen. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Mary Conlon. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Power to the people!
KBOO's Board of Directors is delighted to invite all KBOO members to the annual membership meeting and Board of Directors elections. The meeting will be held on Saturday, September 17th at 1 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. A Zoom link and call-in access will be provided to those who are unable to attend in person. This is the opportunity for all members to meet the candidates, get station updates, and make their voices heard. Again, that's KBOO's annual membership meeting and Board of Directors elections, Saturday, September 17th at 1 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2022.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
Someone will call us up and say, "Hey, my friend works at this Pizza Hut, and this Nazi works there, and he's always talking with her." And so we would go to the Pizza Hut. We would wait there, and when they get off work, we'd follow them home, and then follow them to another home, and then we'd stake that place out, and we would just start making connections. All of a sudden, we had this network that was all scribbled out on a notepad that had like 20 different addresses on it with the major, major hitters on their side, all the Youth of Hitler guys, Aryan Front, American Front. We had all these people's names and addresses just from following people around because we were patient. our Friday nights would be, okay, four of us get together and we go sit out in front of my house, drink a couple beers and talk to each and listen to music, and ooh, someone's coming, here they go, okay, let's follow them to the next house. And then when they're going to try and meet up somewhere, we can dismantle their cars so they can't get there and make it really difficult for them to organize.
This is Jason from Portland's chapter of Anti-Racist Action.
The week before they were all supposed to go to Aryan Nations, we just grab a bunch of Jolly Ranchers and go from house to house to house, putting them in gas tanks so that they all had car trouble and they all had to pay a mechanics bill so that they didn't have as much income to take off for the weekend. We were willing to do a lot of things that a lot of the other groups would not do, or they didn't want to risk the physical scenario, much less getting caught and then having to answer to the police. We are totally willing to do this, and we'll do it so that you don't have to. We made some risky endeavors to get information that was not available. These friendships that were made early on led to, of course, Jonathan calling me up and being like, hey man, I gotta go dig through some trash and I would really like to have a couple people with me. You got it, let's go. We had intel on everybody. We were a little obsessed, but we knew it had to be done.
In our last episode, we looked at the house defense work of the Coalition for Human Dignity, where activists discreetly supported Portlanders targeted by white nationalist violence. In this episode, we offer another example of the coalition's dedication to using a diversity of tactics in the fight to drive white nationalist organizing out of Portland.
We'll hear about the far less public side of the Coalition for Human Dignity, digging through trash, following known racist skinheads, and sabotaging vehicles. The CHD also sent undercover agents to white nationalist meetings and gatherings on delicate and dangerous missions. A wall of secrecy existed between the community-based activities of the coalition and their intelligence work. Who are the people who masterminded and took these risks? What did they do with the information they gathered? I'm Mike Crenshaw.
And I'm Selena Flores. We're your hosts for It Did Happen Here, Episode 8, A Research Capacity, Part 1. By the early 1990s, the Coalition for Human Dignity had shrunk in size but sharpened its focus. Within the broad coalition, a core group of anti-racists publicly confronted neo-Nazis in pickets and marches, organized house defenses, and nurtured ties to street-level anti-racist groups like Anti-Racist Action and Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice. Early on, the CHD identified intelligence gathering as a key part of its mission to expel white power racists from the city. They collected reports from citizens who observed neo-Nazi activity in workplaces and neighborhoods. They worked closely with the Homophobic Violence Documentation Project hotline run by the Lesbian Community Project to identify and address hate crimes. And they collected intelligence on the hundreds of neo-Nazi and far-right groups organizing throughout the Pacific Northwest.
A key figure in this intelligence work was Jonathan Mazzocchi. We heard from him throughout the series. Mazzocchi was a fixture of the Coalition for Human Dignity. Stories place him on the street confronting cops and racists, helping with trainings, organizing large protests. But his passion was digging into the white power movement to learn who they were, where they would be, and how to take them down. Jonathan was a Lewis and Clark student involved in Central American solidarity and socialist politics. His highly principled anti-fascism and detail-oriented approach to fighting the right comes through in his speech, and it's clear that he has the temperament to organize an intelligence operation from the ground up. Jonathan Mazzocchi's comrades and allies speak with great respect of his commitment to the fight against fascism. Right-wing websites to this day post about him with deep hatred.
The Coalition for Human Dignity maintained something called The Shop.
The Shop was the name of the coalition's intelligence headquarters, located in industrial North Portland.
Which was an office that housed 30 filing cabinets full of primary and secondary sources on far-right groups in our area of responsibility, which we took to be the Pacific Northwest. We had a very specialized library of more than 500 volumes. We had hundreds of videotapes and audio tapes, and then we had databases full of license plates from when we would send people to events to write down the license plates, and then we'd have to run them through the Oregon DMV. This would take time, and it was very labor intensive. there were, at that time, hundreds of small papers throughout the region that would include in them letters to the editor, stories by beat reporters, so on and so forth. And if you wanted to get those stories, you had to subscribe to a clipping service, which would take, you know, keywords like white supremacist or anti-immigration. So the service would have someone cut out a whole bunch of clippings, put them into a pack, and then mail them to us. And once we would get them weeks later, we would index them and then put them into a database so that we could monitor them and begin to understand what it was they were doing. So my point here is that that's a lot of volunteers, a lot of labor, and it was a very different information environment. So in order for us to be competent, we had to have funding, we had to have support, we had to have people with basic library science skills. So that's what we did. And so this work was carried out by myself and a few other people, and the late Stu Albert, who was a somewhat famous Yippie from the 60s, was instrumental in the Coalition for Human Dignity. He was on our board in training and helping people like me develop these skills with intelligence gathering. Stu died a few years ago. I miss him terribly. But he was a wonderful link also to 1960s radicalism and what was then the contemporary left.
Another key figure in developing the coalition's intelligence work was Leonard Zeskin, author and research director at the coalition's parent institution, the Center for Democratic Renewal. Zeskin is referred to here by Jonathan as Lenny.
It was Lenny's style of organizing a research-driven local unit. That's primarily his idea. Lenny has a better grasp of all of this, I think, than virtually anyone, really anywhere.
And here's Leonard.
This work takes time and energy, and it takes the ability to, if you're developing the information or organization, it takes months. It doesn't take days. It takes months and sometimes years to develop good information. CHD was willing to do it.
National watchdog organizations like the Anti-Defamation League or the Southern Poverty Law Center used the top-down centralized power structure where local groups were guided by a national headquarters. The CHD's intelligence work, on the other hand, worked on building intelligence and community strength from the grassroots of the communities themselves.
We argued that research should be local and should be carried out in local communities by local people. Local communities have it within their power to monitor their own racists. It's local people who know best what's going on in their communities in order to knit together all of that research and all of that monitoring. We became a regional source to do that. And that meant training and working with hundreds of people in different communities who were tracking all of these groups.
Here is Stephen Gardner, the coalition's intermittent executive director that we met in episode 3.
Three or four people working full-time can't do all of this research. So we trained community researchers, one or two people in each town where there was some kind of activity happening. This ended up being a whole bunch of trainings around the Northwest, basically overviewing the picture of the far right in the Pacific Northwest, what kinds of activities were happening, what communities could do to respond. We were always big believers in informing your community who might target your community, what kinds of ideas, what kinds of ideologies, what kinds of tactics before there was a high-profile hate crime or a march that made the press or something like that.
Again, Jonathan Mazzocchi.
Because the far right was a social movement, and by that we meant it wasn't part of the state. Most of these people were organizing outside of government. They were in citizens groups, grassroots, far-right organizations. Because they were organized in that fashion, it gave us a unique opportunity. We did training sessions to develop skills to research the far-right, and some of that research involved infiltrating them, sending people to meetings. We called this broadly having a research capacity or an intelligence capacity.
What did infiltration look like for the Coalition for Human Dignity? For some, it meant going deep undercover into far-right groups. Other infiltration tactics were simpler. One person trained as an infiltrator and field researcher was Devin Burghardt, who today investigates right-wing fascism at the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights.
I became involved while I was going to school up at Western Washington University. Jonathan Mazzocchi and Stephen Gardner came to do a presentation. They mentioned the fact that the organization had internships. I immediately jumped at the chance. They put me to work going to militia meetings and Klan rallies and other types of events around the region to try to gather the really important investigative research that the organization had become known for. CHD employ pretty much all of the investigative reporting techniques at our fingertips. And that includes the ability to infiltrate and go undercover at events to find out what far-right organizations are doing, to get beyond the public face that these organizations put forward, to find out what their real intentions are and what their real agendas are behind the scenes. The only way to do that is to infiltrate and go undercover. So the internship program helped train and equip me with some of the skills to be able to do some of that initial work, not the deep undercover work that's sometimes required, but the ability to go to public meetings and events and submit reports and write up about what was happening at those events to give a better sense for not only our organization, but other community organizations around the region.
What type of events did neo-Nazis hang out at? Stephen Gardner describes.
We sent people to rallies, or we went to rallies if it was a public event, or places where we knew that were not necessarily Nazi space, but where we expected to find them, punk shows, gun shows, and what came to be called preparedness expos, where survivalists gathered together to trade hints and buy mineral supplements and bayonets. People who would go to events for us, they had clean identities. They were not someone who had been published. This was a pre-internet time. So if you have a P.O. box and you're not an author or something like that, people could be pretty anonymous going to meetings and finding out what was going on directly from Nazis or from Christian patriots. There were probably another 20 to 30 people who were closely involved with us doing that from time to time.
At this point, the Coalition for Human Dignity was a busy, active organization. When Stephen talks about 20 people who operated in the capacity that Devin describes, that means 20 reports to file, 20 people to track that they got home safely, 20 people who maintained a clean identity. That's a lot, especially when we consider that intelligence was just one branch of the organization. Remember, too, the coalition supported people in deep undercover who infiltrated nationally organized neo-Nazi groups. People continue to maintain silence about that work, so there's not a lot we can tell you about it. Coalition activist Abby Layton describes how her work in the CHD was supported by the intelligence.
When we first started out, we actually had these beautiful young people who volunteered to infiltrate. There were quite a few of these brave young people, anti-racist skinheads, who infiltrated into these groups, especially Tom Metzger's group. So we had direct access the minute that there was any information, it came to us.
The Reverend Cecil Charles Prescott was one of the CHD board members back in the 1990s. He's an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ and a brother in the Order of Corpus Christi, and is currently the Director of Faith Formation at Ainsworth United Church of Christ in Portland. Here he describes how CHD's intelligence work supported community defense.
One of the strengths of the Coalition for Human Dignity was the research, which was very, very good, and at the time was rare in terms of finding accurate information, rather than, those are Nazi, we hate them. And coming to an understanding their background, who are the different players and individuals, their history, how they connect, where there are differences among those groups, and also where could you possibly find weak spots? If there were tensions between individuals, how do you work that to diffuse their power and their influence? It just occurred to me that was probably a tactic that was used in terms of knowing who these people were and how to respond to their fears and to their hopes and how to attack them differently.
Again, Devin Burkhart.
It was intense. You always have to be alert and concerned about your security and the security of others. But it was also enlightening because it really helped dispel a lot of the mythology that I think a lot of us have around neo-Nazis and far-right activists. It helps both show the human face of the other side and also introduces you, introduced me to how they interact with one another, how various factions and schisms, how they look at the opposition, how their paranoia impacts all of their activity. All of those kind of things are really illuminating to see. But what was really, I think, at the core is you really saw, once you got behind the scenes, how much race and racism and anti-Semitism really were at the core, driving a lot of this stuff. Even though when they were talking to the public, they tried to often cover up or downplay that stuff. I think what was really most informative was seeing the impact that you could have of exposing what was going on behind the scenes to the larger public and being able to use that information to make a difference on what those organizations were going to do and how they were going to try to impact local communities.
Imagine the work. Activists attended meetings where they sat among the white nationalists, took notes, wrote down who was present, collected license plates, made relationships, then wrote up and submitted reports. These reports were then analyzed for commonalities.
The Coalition for Human Dignity's research arm eroded the denial and propaganda offered by the mainstream news sources. It was the CHD's goal to prove that the speeches of the white nationalists concealed a far more violent threat to peace and public safety than anyone, public or private citizen, wanted to know existed. The surveillance Devin and others provided offered a clearer proof of intent to harm. Again, here's Jonathan Mazzocchi.
We did a program of infiltration focused on the Oregon Citizens Alliance.
The Oregon Citizens Alliance was a fundamentalist anti-choice Christian group rooted in homophobia that in the early 1990s dominated Oregon Republican Party politics. The OCA represented itself as a mainstream organization within acceptable politics while legislatively dismantling human rights of queer Oregonians. The Coalition for Human Dignity toiled for years against the Oregon Citizens Alliance.
You know, the Oregon Citizens Alliance in the late 80s, they had already successfully overturned a governor's order banning discrimination in public employment. They had already succeeded in doing that by the time that they made this ballot measure statewide that would have banned LGBTQ rights within public employment. And you got to understand that, you know, on the left, among many liberals and progressives, the Christian right was often treated as something that was from the past, that we had overcome, and not politically relevant, that they were just dismissed as an irrelevant political force. Back then, we were like, no, that's not the case. These movements have always been with us. They will always be with us, and they always must be fought. We wanted to know everything about them. You do because that makes it easier to fight them.
We've heard how the intelligence was used against white nationalist movements. What tactics did the CHD use locally to expose and discourage individual racists? Here's Stephen Gardner, an anti-fascist activist, M. Trelor.
The most effective things were direct interventions. Now, that included Sharp/ARA confrontation, but it also included if they have a public event to show up with many more people than they did and confront them more rhetorically. That included outing them. This was a strategy to make them visible in the community. So to call up employers and say, look, do you know you have a Nazi working for you doing customer service who has visible swastika tattoos? Do you really want that? We had a known violent skinhead who was living in an apartment complex where there were vulnerable people. We would call up the landlord and say, look, this is a person with a history of violence. Within the applicable fair housing laws, do you really want this person living in your space? And usually what they would do is they would look at it and say, huh, this person is having a party every weekend and trashing the walls with hammer blows. Maybe we have good cause to ask them to go elsewhere. And so what happened with some of these tactics is it kept them from congregating in the city of Portland. We always tried to think, okay, who's going to be most vulnerable? And, you know, how can we do whatever it takes to move these folks away from the most vulnerable communities?
Then the other thing we did that was a little bit more controversial within the group was we said they can't hold a job. If we find out that they have a job anywhere within 50 miles, we'll show up and we'll tell their coworkers. We did that several times. So folks would call in and say, so-and-so's a Nazi and he's working here. And we'd say, okay, we'll investigate it. And it was not always true, but it was true often enough that we could say, okay, let's get together 50, 60 people and show up at the Olive Gardens and we're going to picket there. And we would have their name and, if possible, their photo on a flyer. We'd say, this is what we know about this person. He's working here. And then we would tell the manager, we're going to be here. Everybody who eats here and works here deserves to know you got a Nazi in the back room. And that drew people towards us, gave us credibility, and gave us a sense of what we're doing matters, because it did. Every time we did it, they lost their job, and I'm proud of that. It drove them out of where they were and made their lives more difficult. We would talk to them through secondary sources. We just put the word out. If you don't want this to happen, all you have to do is say, I'm no longer part of this grouping. If you drop out of this grouping, we'll leave you alone. If you stay part of this grouping, we're going to make your life hell wherever we find you. Some of them, it probably pushed them more so into the grouping, as in, everybody hates me, therefore I'm going to stick with my Nazi brothers. Many of them quit. There were 200, 300 Nazi boneheads in the area at one point, and the ones who did not go to prison drifted away. And they drifted away because their choices were either form a new tightly knit grouping or cease to be part of this so I can get on with my life. You can say there was a generational choice, but some of them, they hunkered down and eventually became Volksfront.
We debriefed people who didn't want to be Nazis anymore. So we spent a lot of time with anyone who wanted to come out, asking them, you know, why did they get in and what kind of activities were their groups involved in it, what are your biggest concerns, and so on. And again, when it came to ex-Nazis, we were like, if you were once a Nazi, it's not enough just to say I'm no longer a Nazi. You can't be neutral in this particular fight. It's not ethically tenable. If you're going to come out, you're going to come all the way out and tell what you know.
A thorn in the side of both the CHD in general and Jonathan Mazzocchi in particular was Portland cop Lauren Christensen, a Portland Police Bureau member and a high-level influencer within the state's gang task force. Christensen was despised amongst Portland leftists as he undercut the hard work of anti-fascist groups, including the CHD, by repeatedly associating anti-racist skinheads and punks with racist skins, muddling them all together as youth gang culture rather than as specific subcultural groups. Jonathan Mazzocchi relates a personal triumph in his intelligence career.
One of the things I did personally that the Coalition for Human Dignity is not responsible for, but that I did is I managed to get a hold of Lauren Christensen's unredacted internal intelligence reports. I managed to get those over a period of, I think, 6 months or a year. And then we used that information to have a more effective means of fighting these racist groups. So these intelligence reports, so you understand, every time a cop came up upon a racist skinhead group and then interviewed them or arrested them or whatever, it would go into these summarized intelligence reports. The names, addresses, workplaces, social security, and there was just a wealth of data in there. I managed to get a steady stream of those reports. And then we used them to fight these guys. When I was stealing his reports, it also gave us a better way to contradict him in the press. When he was saying, oh, this group, they're just a bunch of kids, they're nothing. We were like, well, actually, you know, they were all at an Aryan Nations compound last weekend working with very professional neo-Nazis. That doesn't sound like wayward youth that sounds pretty serious. So it helped us politically make our arguments also.
The research that told us that it was going to require a multiplicity of tactics, require direct action, require organizing to expose and confront white supremacists when they were rallying and holding public events, because that sent a message that the community wasn't going to remain silent and that Portland was no longer going to be a fertile recruiting ground for folks in the wake of white supremacist activity, that they weren't alone, that they could face the fear together. But it was really important also to expose their activities in which white supremacists were targeting for new recruits. So in essence, trying to inoculate communities that were vulnerable to white supremacist recruitment to get them to draw a bright line, to exclude white supremacists from their subculture or from their organizing or from any of their other work. I think what was really important is to get more people to take it seriously, because back then, it was really hard. It was often dismissed as local street gang activity. It was dismissed as harmless graffiti. But by doing effective and long-term research and organizing on it, you could show the larger community that this was, in fact, politically motivated, that it was designed to harass and intimidate Jews and people of color. It was designed to bring about the kind of society that white supremacists had dreamed of. And you could also then expose people to the larger networks and organizations that were providing aid and support. That was effective in getting more people to take the stuff seriously, from city government to law enforcement to everyone else. Removing it from simply a fight for the streets to making it a fight for the kind of heart and soul of the entire city.
Thanks for listening to this episode of It Did Happen Here. The transcripts, show notes with links, full credit.